The following sermon is brought to you by Cornerstone Baptist Church. For more information on our teaching and preaching ministry, visit us online at cornerstoneorlando.org.
Let's go ahead and we'll open up to Mark chapter 12, and we'll begin with part two of what is the greatest commandment. And we'll read the text once more. Mark chapter 12, verses 28 to 34. Then one of the scribes came, and having heard them reasoning together, perceiving that he had answered them well, asked him, "Which is the first commandment of all?" And Jesus answered him, "The first of all the commandments is, 'Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. And you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, and with all your soul, and with all your mind, and with all your strength.' This is the first commandment. And the second, like it, is this: you shall love your neighbor as yourself. There is no other commandment greater than these." So the scribe said to him, "Well said, teacher. You have spoken the truth, for there is one God, and there is no other but He. And to love Him with all the heart, and with all the understanding, and with all the soul, and with all the strength, and to love one neighbor as oneself, is more than all the burnt offerings and sacrifices." Then when Jesus saw that he answered wisely, he said to him, "You are not far from the kingdom of God." But after that, no one dared question him. So we're beginning to answer the question, what is the greatest commandment? And so we can ask, this question is often asked again and again with various themes. Remember, we could ask the question, what is the greatest musician? And my wife would say Bach and the things that he's composed. We could ask, what's the greatest movie? And I know TJ is our movie buff, right? Or what is the greatest movie that has ever been made? When we think about what is the greatest, we must begin to understand what is the greatest commandment. The greatest commandment is to love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and mind. And then the second part to that is to love your neighbor. If you would think of how people relate these two and how people forget the necessary connection between these two. For in other words, some people want good fruit, but they don't want to be connected to the root. The root is the love for God. The love for God is what produces the good fruit of love for our neighbor. And we can't have that good fruit of love for our neighbor without a true and genuine love for God. And we don't have a true and genuine love for God if we don't have love for our neighbor. There's no life in that tree if there's no fruit. But you can't have that fruit apart from connected to the root of this tree. And so true love of God is connected always with love for our neighbor, love for our family members, love for people that we live with, love for those who are our neighbor. And so the first commandment is the trunk of the tree, the first part of our commandment we covered this morning, love for God. The second part is the branch with its fruit. So we remember the things that we covered this morning. In verse 28, we saw who came to Jesus with the question. We saw why he came with the question and what his question was, which is the first commandment of all in verse 28. And then we began to see who it is that we're to love in verse 29. It's the Lord our God, the Lord who is one. And then we saw how we're to relate to him in verse 30. We are to love the Lord our God with all our heart, soul, mind, and strength. This is the first commandment. So now we're picking up in the second part of Jesus' answer in verse 31. And tonight we'll look at verses 31 down to 34. And if you have your outline from this morning, you can follow along and remember that we'll complete the part of the great answer. And then we'll look at the scribe's wise response in verses 32 to 33. And lastly, we'll see in verse 34 how Jesus says, you're not far from the kingdom. So we're picking up mid-sentence from Jesus Christ, where we cut him off earlier this morning, to begin to fill in the rest of his teaching, the rest of his explanation. This greatest commandment has two parts to it, and now he begins to describe the second part to it. So in verse 31, he says the second like it is this: you shall love your neighbor as yourself. So we're remembering our definition from this morning with what is true love. Did anybody write it down? It was long. I'm going to give you another opportunity to write it down. So our biblical definition of love: a selfless, enduring commitment of the will, a selfless, enduring commitment of the will to care about and benefit another person by righteous, truthful, and compassionate thoughts, words, and actions. It's long because it's detailed. It's long because it's describing what love isn't and what love is. And so we covered this morning about how it's selfless. We'll need to deny ourselves. There needs to be a commitment of the will. It's not simply emotions. It's not simply how you feel, but it's a decision and a commitment of the will to care about and benefit someone. And you can't do that by your own decisions, your own description of what love is. You have to do that in a righteous way. You have to do that in the way that God has outlined by his word. You need to do it in a truthful way, and you need to do it in a compassionate way, in the thoughts, words, and actions that we do. And so Jesus picks up in verse 31, and in verse 30 we had love towards God, which is godliness, as opposed to godlessness. And now in verse 31, we have goodness towards man, as opposed to unrighteousness. You can't have the first without the second, and you can't have the second without the first. And when it's truly together, love for God will produce love for man. That's why they are one command with two parts. And so you can't start in this way. How you feel, you can't start with man and your own thinking about what love is. If you end up bringing in your own definition of what love is, then you turn your definition of love into great sin. And so we see that today in the way that America talks about love. Apart from God's law, apart from God's word to define what that love is, apart from that truth, it's essentially how I feel, how I can affirm someone no matter what they do. As long as I'm affirming them and encouraging them, then that is love. But the law of God defines what the love is. We can't make up what love is to our neighbor. We need to hear it from God what that love is. And so in Galatians 5, all the law is fulfilled in this: you shall love your neighbor as yourself. 1 Corinthians 13 speaks of love as being patient, kind, long-suffering, not prideful, not parading, but instead rejoicing in the truth. Romans 13, 8-10 speaks about how he who loves another has fulfilled the law. Love is the fulfillment of the law. So these things go together. The law teaches us how to love one another. And so when you look at the law of God and you begin to analyze it, take the Ten Commandments, for example, it will teach you how to love one another. When the law of God says not to murder, you know that it also teaches you not to hate, teaches you not to be angry, teaches you not to have a murderer's heart. But it also teaches you the opposite. It also teaches you the necessity to care for the spiritual well-being of another, to care for the good of another. When God has said not to commit murder, he's also teaching us that we need to protect life. We need to love and not hate or be angry. When God says to honor your father and mother, it's not simply disobedience to them, but it's in teaching us the importance of the positive. To honor, love them is to not to dishonor them, but rather to work at how you can grow in respect, love, and care for your parents. When we consider the command for adultery, and not to, we know it says not to commit adultery, and we know in the heart not to think it, not to commit lust. But then we think also the law is teaching us how to love our neighbor, and that we are to think in a way that would be love for your spouse, or purity in singleness, waiting for the one that God would have you to be with. When the law tells us not to steal, we know it's love not to take the possessions of another. But it's also love to do the opposite, to seek and to provide for others, to care for the poor. That is love. We know that the law tells us not to lie. And so certainly protecting the truth is loving to one another. But also we're not to slander one another. We're to be very careful with our mouths and how we speak about one another in order to help them and edify them. And so we're learning and we're defining what love is by what the commandments that God has given. That's what it means in Romans 13 when he who loves one another has fulfilled the law. If you really love, then you will look at these things and you will look to fulfill these things with one another. And the love is fulfillment of this law. If you are loving, then you are doing these things. We know that the law says not to covet, not to desire what someone else has. But then we need to think of how to be loving by thinking of what others need and what their desires are, how to help them beforehand. What's interesting is if you look at Leviticus 19, verses 10 to 18, where it describes some of these things of the moral law, you can begin to see already how in Leviticus these things are described, not only the negative, but also the positive. It was already there in the Old Testament before. And then it's just repeated and expounded and explained all the more how we are to love one another. And so we must remember the foolishness that it will lead to. If we do not have the law to define what love is, then love, it just is becomes our own feelings and emotions and completely contradictory. If I say that I believe that it's loving to be a homosexual, and then someone else says it's loving not to abuse someone sexually, or if someone says pedophilia is the next thing that's coming up in America, right? Where they'll say that's the next letter to add to the LGBT. And so if that comes in, the next letter, see the foolish contradiction between what is defined as love and then protection for children. And needing to, you can see the contradiction between opinions and feelings about what love is. We're hopeless and helpless apart from God defining what love is. And so we consider these things that Jesus is commanding us and teaching us. This is the second part. You remember the story of the Good Samaritan? This is the Jesus teaching this very fact. Someone asked, how do I love my neighbor? And so Jesus tells a story. He tells a story full of racial tension, a story full of a Samaritan who has racial tension with a Jew, who ends up helping him out, and the religious people don't. And so Jesus uses this example where it was a dangerous thing to help, for that Samaritan to help the Jewish man. It was, the Samaritan put himself at risk in order to help him on the side of the road. And so we're learning from this example how love is costly. It will be painful to you to love one another. Sometimes it's dangerous. Sometimes it costs financially. And it's not for just those who are like you are those who think the way you do. This story teaches us how to love one another. Charles Simeon says about this passage that we must do all that we can for another's spiritual good. It's not simply the physical good that was in mind, but to the greatest extent, that with the greatest excellence, with the greatest importance, we need, if we love God, we need to love one another. Look at how Jesus defines it now in verse 31. He puts the qualifier on it, to love your neighbor as yourself. Many have picked up this phrase and say, ah, see, you need to love yourself first before you can love one another. But that's a twisting of the commandment. It's a twisting of the idea. Self-esteem and self-love are not taught anywhere in the Bible. You don't need to grow in pride in order to love one another. No, you need to get rid of pride in order to love one another. Pride is the hindrance, the obstacle, the great obstacle to love. Only humble people love. Only humble people love. And so when the psychology abuses this saying, Christian psychology abuses this saying, saying that you need to learn, love yourself, it's a simple lie. That's like saying that you need to grow in pride and, or foolishness in order to love. Your problem is not too little, it's not too much self-esteem. The problem that why we don't love is we think too highly of ourselves. And when we think too highly of ourselves, then we won't love one another. So are you willing to, what it is teaching then? What is it teaching then? Are you willing to love one another with the same intensity, the same fervency, the same amount that you naturally love yourself? You naturally are planning out, what am I going to do after the service? What am I going to do tonight? What am I going to do tomorrow? You're naturally thinking about yourself. I'm hungry. I got to go to the bathroom. I'm thirsty. I'm tired. I'm young. I'm old. I'm whatever. You naturally think about yourself. And so Jesus is saying, since you naturally think about yourself, the commandment is, the second part of the greatest commandment is to think about others with this same fervency, this same intensity, this same amount. Ask yourself, and all the things that you seek for yourself, do you seek that good for others? Are you willing to do good for yourself only? And so we remember Jesus uniting these two commandments in verse 31. And we observe again, like we did this morning, look in verse 30. At the end of verse 30, this is the first commandment, singular. And then the second part of verse 31, there is no other commandment, singular, greater than these, plural. So Jesus has this one commandment with two parts. Love God, love your neighbor as yourself. It is pure. It is righteous. It stands as a great standard to us. So now that we've seen Jesus' great answer, let's begin to look at the scribe's wise response. This scribe who was originally coming with a plan to test Jesus, meeting with the other Pharisees, and now he decides to throw his question to Jesus, and he decides to throw Jesus a fastball right down the middle of the plate, and Jesus knocks it out of the park. Home run. Jesus is rounding the bases. He comes in. Everyone amazed at the beauty in which Jesus answers, the succinct nature in which he answers. And the scribe, originally coming to test Jesus, now begins to look and to become won over by what Jesus has said. So the scribe, in verse 32 we read, so the scribe said to him, well said, teacher, you have spoken the truth, for there is one God, and there is no other but he. And to love him with all the heart and with all the understanding, with all the soul and with all the strength, to love one's neighbor as oneself is more than the whole burnt offerings and sacrifices. So the scribe says this was a good answer. This was right. This was an excellent answer. Well done, Jesus. Well done. And he responds and he refers to Jesus as the teacher with a term of respect. There's no other scribe in Mark's account who's responded in this way. This man is responding in a different way. And so what he says is Jesus has said the truth. He admits that Jesus' response was reasonable and leads to the greatest happiness, the greatest holiness, and it displays the worth of God. The scribe has nothing but good to say about Jesus. So this scribe doesn't have the same evil motives. He's not filled with the same pride and hypocrisy as the other spiritual leaders. And he points out what Jesus said about God and who he is in verse 32 is right. There is only one God. Perhaps the scribe is thinking of Isaiah 45, where God describes that he himself is God alone. And he describes how his sovereignty and how he alone knows the future. In verse 33, we see him comment about what Jesus has taught. He summarizes the same statement that is beautiful, and we've repeated it many times with all the heart, all the understanding, all the soul, all the strength. And he repeats in a slightly different way. And that helps us to understand that what Jesus is saying in verse 30 is not a description of who man is and a four-parted being or a three-parted being. He's not describing that. He's describing what it means to comprehensively, what it means to truly love God. And so we pick up in verse 33 where he says, to love one's neighbor as oneself is more than all burnt offerings and sacrifices. He says all the rituals that we would do, hypocrites can take delight in those things. Hypocrites can take delight in ceremony. Hypocrites can come to church. Hypocrites can pray. Hypocrites can evangelize. Hypocrites can read their Bible. But what Jesus says has gone beyond that. It's more than simply ceremony. It's true religion. It's true worship. How much easier it is to do those things than to truly love your neighbor as yourself. The moral law is good for its own sake. The moral law that God has given us, these commands in the Ten Commandments, are good and righteous and holy. And the ceremonies that God has given us are good and righteous and holy. For you to be here tonight on his day is good and righteous and holy. But then what he's saying is going beyond that, going beyond what the hypocrite can do. So when you think about this description of what the scribe is saying to Jesus, you can think about someone who is in need of a particular item. They're in need of food, let's say. They're in need of food, and you have the food. You have the bag of food. And you're out somewheres, a distance, you're in the country. The country of Bithlo, or wherever. Where do you live, Pastor Rick?
Mims,
way out there. Way out there with the natives and everything. No place to eat, no place to buy food for a long ways. You got food. Somebody needs food, and you give them $5. But you got the food in your hand. You see? What you should do, is give them what they need, right? Why give them the money when you can give them what they need? And so Jesus, the ceremony is like the money. The love is like the bag of food. What does God want? What does God want? You can use the ceremony to love him. It's true. You can use the service to love him. You can use the prayer time to love him. You can use those things, and you should. You should. But what does he want out of those things? Why does he want you to do any of those things? For love. For love. And so what the scribe is saying is true. Where all the burnt offerings, all the sacrifices that you can give to God, they are good. It's good to give sacrifices and offerings. But why would you give them? Because this is the heart of the commandment. And it's greater than all the ceremony. So we've seen the second part of the commandment in verse 31. We've seen the scribe's wise response in verses 32 to 33. Lastly, let's look now at Jesus' encouraging statement, you're not far from the kingdom. Now when Jesus begins to describe in verse 34, now when Jesus saw that he'd answered wisely, he said to him, "You're not far from the kingdom of God." But after that, no one dared question him. Jesus looks at the scribe and sees he's answered sensibly. He's answered thoughtfully. He's using his mind. Sin has not blinded him like others, like the other religious leaders. He's able to see what's right. The man also wanted to do what is right. But notice how wise Jesus' statement is, and so well balanced between encouragement and yet stating the truth. This man is still yet unconverted. But Jesus doesn't just rebuke him or confront him. He says an encouraging thing, and yet at the same time as saying an encouraging thing, there's still an exhortation in it. Do you see that? By saying you're not far from the kingdom. Imagine somebody's in line at Disney, right? You're in one of those 1.5-hour long lines. And then you get up to the front, and you get all the way up, and then they close the doors to whatever ride, and you're the very front. And the person working at Disney says, means to encourage you. And they say, "You're not far from getting on the ride. You are the next one." By saying that truth, Jesus is admitting, you're not a Christian. If you died now, you go to hell. But he does it in the nicest possible way you can do it. This man is not attacking him, Jesus, anymore. Jesus has a different response with those who are hard-hearted. He responds to them in a hard way. But with the man who's soft here, the man who's seeing the depth of what Jesus is saying, he means to state his horrible state truthfully, but in such an encouraging way that he's right there at the doors. Why is he right? Why does Jesus describe him in this way? Because to understand these things, these heart truths that are not easy to understand, it's easy to talk about love. It's easy to have a false definition of love. But for this man to comprehend the true nature in which Jesus is talking about love for God and love for neighbor and how that is the greatest, for him to truly understand these things is to understand a profound truth. And so understanding of these things prepares you for the gospel. It prepares you and teaches you for the need, your own need for the gospel. Submission to God's rules, values, and purposes in this world is preparing this person, helping them to understand what it means to be a Christian. And Jesus is speaking from a human perspective. From a human perspective, he's speaking and addressing this man, encouraging him that he would be should move on, not stay, be content with where he's at. The person who's at the edge of the net to get on the ride, right? They're the first person. They're not content to stay there, but they're encouraged. They're encouraged in how far they've made it and how little yet they have to go, right? And so Jesus wisely does this. It's like saying you're just on the other side of the road. So wake up. Wake up. Don't be content to where you're at. Don't stop there. Come all the way into the kingdom. Jesus does both in an encouraging way, in a truthful way, and yet in a warning way. A warning way that if he were to stay there, he's not in the kingdom. If he were to stay there, he would not go to heaven. He needs to come to the next step, the next step of what the law is driving him towards, what the law is teaching him to do. With us in the account of Mark, we're left to wonder what will happen to this man. We find no more about this man, whether he's in heaven or hell. We'll find out one day, right? But Mark closes this text by saying, and no one dared question him anymore. But after that, no one dared question him. Jesus has defeated all his enemies, and now after this, he'll go on the offensive in verses 35 to 37, or 35 to 44. Jesus has perfectly answered all the objections. No one can dare even come to attack him anymore because of how clearly he makes the truth, but how clearly he refutes their false religion and exalts what God has given as and described as true religion. And so, when we close, we want to think about Jesus' statement about how you're not far from the kingdom. And we want to heed the warning and take the encouragement. We heed the warning and take the encouragement by doing the same thing, by considering the same similar truths that the law of God teaches us here. This commandment is pure and righteous. This commandment that we're to love our neighbor teaches us about God. It teaches us about ourselves. It teaches us about our need for Christ and our need to love one another in the same way. See how this side is of the greatest commandment. Like we saw, the greatest commandment, like a great rock, right? A great mountain. Walk to the other side of this great mountain and you will see the other aspect of it. The other aspect of this great hill, this great mountain. So if God has taught us that loving one another is the great part of the greatest commandment, what does that say about God and how he loves one another? How he loves sinners. It teaches us his great love that he would make and connect this as part of the greatest commandment. It teaches us that he spreads this by teaching us, his true children, to love one another. It's the expression of his love and why he's done this, why he's connected these commandments. When we look and think about how we have not loved one another, this commandment teaches us great goodness in God, great love in God, but it also teaches us our great lack of love for one another. When you think about how you lack of love for one another, you can do it in ways. You can think about categories. You know, with your wife, you can do it with your children. It's different. You can do it with your extended family. You can do it at work. You can do it at church. You can think about strangers. You can think about friends. There's many different areas and circles in your life, right? And sometimes we sin in different areas, in different areas of life. And we always need to be considering how we can love one another. And it takes great wisdom. It takes great discipline. It takes great humility. And the truth is, this commandment is another pure and holy commandment. And all the commandment will do, if left there, will say the truth to you. It will say the truth to you that you have not loved like you should. We have not loved like we should. We should have had the law define what love is, not our own hearts. We should have said the truth, but said it within a loving way, not trying to cram it down somebody's throat. We should have grown in many, many ways in love for one another. The law is there to be pure truth, to stand there and tell you the truth. You're a sinner. You're not loving. You have not loved like you should. And so we can do this by thinking back on all the people that you've hurt. You can think back and the people that you've loved the most in your own life. At times, you have hurt them the most. You can remember the tears in their eyes. You can remember how something you have said, something you have done, has been the opposite of love. That's what the pure law does. It teaches you God is holy and you are sinful. But what does it do? How does it drive us to the gospel? Look again at 1 John 4, connecting these same things. 1 John also connects these two parts of the greatest commandment. 1 John 4. Beloved, 1 John 4, 7. Beloved, let us love one another, for love is of God. And everyone who loves is born of God and knows God. But he who does not love does not know God, for God is love.